Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Hosea chapter 4, which I will entitle The Lord Accuses Israel. Hosea is prophesying in the 8th century BC before the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel, to whom he is prophesying. That occurred in 722 when the Assyrians came in and deported all of northern Israel all over the ancient Near East. Now, Hosea has been told to marry a prostitute who then later became an adulteress. She symbolized, of course, the adulteress Israel. She had three kids. One was called Jezreel, which means scattered. That shows that Israel was going to be scattered by the Assyrians in 722, northern Israel. But then Jezreel also means sown, because they're going to be sown back in the land. So the good news is there also, they return from captivity, ultimately from Babylon in 586 BC, and they are back in the land. And then she had another daughter called Lo-Ruhamah, which means no compassion. Israel was not going to be shown any compassion before they got wiped out by the Assyrians. But then Israel will be called Ruhamah, which means compassion, as Paul says. That refers to the establishment of the new Israel, the new covenant church, when God shows compassion on his people. And then the third child was called Lo-Ami, not a people, because Israel was not going to be a people when she got scattered. But then Paul says she's going to be called Ami, a people, the new covenant Israel. That's in Romans 9:24. So that's our background. We start now in Hosea 4, verses 1 through 4, and we're going to see God is basically going to read Israel the riot act in this chapter. Listen to the word of the Lord, O sons of Israel, for the Lord has a case against the inhabitants of the land, because there is no faithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land. This is Hosea speaking to the people of northern Israel. There is swearing, deception, murder, stealing, and adultery. They employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore the land mourns, and everyone who lives in it languishes, along with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky, and also the fish of the sea disappear. You let no one find fault, and let none offer reproof, for your people are like those who contend with the priest. In verse 1, Hosea said, there is no faithfulness. The King James says, there is no truth or kindness or knowledge of God in the land. And after basically talking about all the sins of the Israelites, in verse 4, we read, yet let no one find fault. In other words, let no one find fault with the words of Hosea the prophet. There is no defense against Hosea's charge, so let no one find fault with what Hosea is saying. Let none offer reproof, for your people are like those who contend with the priest. And that's a reference to Deuteronomy 17:12. It was a capital crime to oppose a priest. Let me read that verse for you. The man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priest, who stands there to serve the Lord your God, nor to the judge, that man shall die. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. Pretty serious business to oppose the holy words of a priest. You don't mess with the priest. You die. And Hosea is saying the northern Israelites are like people who are getting ready to die because they're fighting with the priest of God. We go now to Hosea 4, verses 5 through 8. Hosea continues. Actually, it's God speaking through Hosea who continues. So you will stumble by day, and the prophet also will stumble with you by night. And I will destroy your mother. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I also will reject you from being my priest. Since you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children. The more they multiplied, the more they sinned against me. I will change their glory into shame. They feed on the sin of my people and direct their desire toward their iniquity. In verse 5, Hosea says, God says, you will stumble by day, captured without a snare, without an ambush, you'll just stumble. It's bad enough to stumble in the night, but Israel was so blind, they stumbled in the day. They also stumble at night, too. Adam Clark says this is a reference to false prophets making prognostication by the stars. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's an interesting idea. But here we have false prophets, they're blind, they're leading the blind, and they're in darkness. You can't get any blinder than that. And then God says, I will destroy your mother. Of course, that's the nation of northern Israel, as Ellicott says. In verse 6, my people are destroyed. That's the 10 tribes. It can't be all of Israel because there's always a remnant because of those covenant promises. I will make your descendants cover the world as the sand covers the seashore, as the oceans cover the globe. to be a blessing to all the nations. So God's people are not totally destroyed, but they're pretty thinned out after the Assyrians come. My people destroyed for lack of knowledge, of course, that's the knowledge of God. In verse 1, Hosea has said there is no faithfulness nor kindness or knowledge of God in the land. Nobody knew God. My people destroyed for lack of knowledge. Well, that's easy. The context is easy. However, as a gentleman named Keithley says on the internet, this verse, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, is the most misquoted verse in the Bible. That verse is even quoted by health food nuts. My people are destroyed because they have lack of knowledge of nutrition. No, folks. It's knowledge of God. I mean, you can make an application, but the original intention of this verse is lack of knowledge of God will destroy you. Look at the morons who are running around saying it's all right to be able to change your genders, which is the fashionable stupidity at this moment in time. They're destroying themselves, and they're destroying innocent kids along with it, too. The pagans had a saying, whom the gods will destroy, they first must make mad. Lack of knowledge will kill you. Lack of knowledge of God will kill you. It will destroy you. That's not only on a national level, that's on an individual level. Sooner or later, you will be destroyed without knowledge of God. And because you, Northern Israel, have rejected knowledge, I also will reject you from being my priest. A priest is a representative, of course, and the Northern Israelites were representative of God. But no more. God's going to say, you're not going to represent me anymore. Think about the priest that Jeroboam had made. Remember, he had set up an illegal religion, the golden calf religion, put altars at Dan and Bethel, and they worshipped golden calves. They worshipped Yahweh in the form of a golden calf. These priests that Jeroboam had appointed were ignorant and illiterate men. They were not Levites. We read that in 1 Kings 12, verse 31. Jeroboam also built shrines on the high places and set up priests from every class of people who were not Levites. So he violated the law there. 1 Kings 13, 33. After all this, Jeroboam did not repent of his evil way, but again set up priests for the high places from every class of people. He ordained whoever so desired it, and they became priests of the high places. Now, every class of people means people who are not Levites, of course. It also might mean lowlifes, adulterers, thieves, blasphemers, who knows? Doesn't sound too promising. But at any rate, this priesthood is going to be rejected by God. You will no longer be my priest, Hosea says in verse 6. So then God says, you've forgotten the law? Well, I've forgotten your children. You're not going to be blessed anymore. The covenant people, the more they multiplied, the more they sinned. I will change their glory into shame. And of course, they were shamed when Assyria came in 722 and wiped out the nation. So they, that's the children of Israel, feed on the sin of my people. They feed on sin. Now that word sin can also be translated as sin offering. And so the children could be feeding on the sin offerings of the people. One of my commentators suggested that could refer to bribes given in the form of a sin offering to a priest. In other words, the priests are feeding on the bribes when they take sin offerings from the people. The priests use it for themselves rather than sacrifice them properly. That's a little speculative in my opinion, but we get the idea. Israel is sinful to the max. We go now to Hosea 4, verses 9 through 14. God continues speaking through Hosea, and it will be like people like priests, so I will punish them for their ways and repay them for their deeds. They will eat, but not have enough. They will play the harlot, but not increase, because they have stopped giving heed to the Lord. Harlotry, wine, and new wine take away the understanding. My people consult their wooden idol, and their diviner's wand informs them. For a spirit of harlotry has led them astray, and they have played the harlot, departing from their God. They offer sacrifices on the tops of the mountains and burn incense on the hills under oak, poplar, and terebinth because their shade is pleasant. Therefore your daughters play the harlot and your brides commit adultery. I will not punish your daughters when they play the harlot or your brides when they commit adultery, for the men themselves go apart with harlots and offer sacrifices with temple prostitutes. So the people without understanding are ruined. Without understanding, without knowledge. There's that idea again. Without knowledge, people are destroyed. In verse 9, Hosea says it will be like people like priests. In other words, both people and priests are going to be punished equally. It doesn't matter if you're a big shot or if you're an ordinary person. I will punish them, both of them, for their ways. And then God goes on a rant against the harlotry, which is spiritual adultery, the drunkenness, wine and new wine, the harlotry, spiritual adultery, Then he mentions wooden idols in verse 12 and diviner's wands. Think about these people going out looking for water. They always have this piece of wood that looks like a chicken wishbone, and they follow that thing to where the water is. Apparently, that's an old idea. People that are listening to demons use little wands to point them to places. Verse 13, the harlotress northern Israelites offer sacrifices on the tops of mountains. Why the tops? That was a common place for idol shrines. The idolaters thought they could get closer to their gods in the heavens. They burn incense on the hills. Of course, pagan worship often involved incense. Under oak, poplar, and terebinth, because the shade is pleasant, not only was the top of a mountain close to the so-called gods, but also it was nice and cool up there. Nice place to go up there. Now, Yahweh singles out the women from the men, starting in verse 13. Your daughters play the harlot, and your brides commit adultery. If you're a man, what's the worst thing that could happen to you? Your wife commits adultery, and your daughter turns into a whore. That would just be the worst that could happen in your family. But God says he's not going to punish those daughters. He's not going to punish those daughters who are whores or those brides who are committing adultery. Why? Because the men are just as bad. They are going after harlots. And they are even sacrificing with temple prostitutes. It's one thing to go with a harlot just for lust, but to go and join yourself to a pagan god by going to a temple prostitute. So God's going to let the women off because the men are more responsible. So the people without understanding are ruined. Again, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Verse 14 at the end says, so the people without understanding are ruined. It's the same idea. You don't know God, you get destroyed. Now let's sum up all of this harlotrous activity of the northern Israelites. The men in verse 14 are said to go apart with harlots. Now this is how Adam Clark describes that going apart. He says, quote, a reference here to certain debaucheries which should not be described. The state of the people at this time must have been abominable beyond all precedent. Animal, sensual, bestial, diabolical. Women consecrating themselves to serve their idols by public prostitution. Boys dismembered like the galli or priest of Cybele. Men and women acting unnaturally, that means homosexually, and all conjoining to act diabolically. Now that's a description, and that's probably exactly how it was. John Gill says that the people of northern Israel, quote, separated themselves to Baal Peor, that shameful idol, who's going to be mentioned later in Hosea 9:10, the Priapus of the Gentiles. Priapus is a Roman god, or a Greek god, I forgot which, but we get the word Priapism from that god. A priapism is when you take Cialis or Viagra and the effects don't wear off. You have a priapism. This was a naughty god. And John Gill says that's who they were devoting themselves to, in whose idolatrous worship many obscene rites were used. I'm sure it was pretty nasty. We go now to Hosea 4, verse 15. God continues speaking through Hosea. Though you, Israel, play the harlot, do not let Judah become guilty. Also, do not go to Gilgal or go up to Beth-Aven and take the oath as the Lord lives. Now, this verse is a little strange. First of all, let's talk about Judah, because Judah is mentioned here. Mostly, Hosea is talking about northern Israel and talking to northern Israel, but here he mentions Judah. Now, Judah was not totally dissolute like Israel was. Judah still had the legal worship of God in Jerusalem, the proper priesthood, the proper Levites, the proper festivals. And so what this verse is going about is to say, look, you are pathetically dissolute in northern Israel, but how about don't make Judah even worse than she is? Don't let Judah become guilty. All right, so how does northern Israel not let Judah become guilty? First of all, do not go to Gilgal. Well, what does that mean? Why would Israel be exhorted not to go to Gilgal? Well, first of all, Gilgal is on the border of Judah. There were lots of Gilgals, but I'm assuming this is the one that was between Jericho and the Jordan. It was easy to corrupt Judah from there because Gilgal was close to Judah. But not only that, a lot of religious things, a lot of spiritual things that happened at Gilgal. For example, the first Passover ever celebrated in Israel was done at Gilgal. The Ark and Tabernacle stayed there for a while at Gilgal. The covenant of circumcision was renewed after Joshua and the Israelites passed over the Jordan. Jeroboam the first northern king of Israel, 931 to 910, he reigned. He wanted to co-opt all those religious associations connected with Gilgal so that people would think his worship was the standard one. Let me read you what Barnes says. Quote, Gilgal lay between Jericho and the Jordan. There, 10 furlongs from the Jordan, first in all the promised land, the people encamped. There Joshua placed the monument of the miraculous passage of the Jordan. There he renewed the circumcision of the people which had been intermitted in the wilderness, and the feast of the Passover. There the people returned after all the victories by which God gave them possession of the land of promise. There Samuel habitually sacrificed, and there before the Lord, i.e. in his special covenanted presence, he publicly made Saul king. It was part of the policy of Jeroboam to take hold of all these associations as a sort of set-off against Jerusalem and the temple from which he had separated his people. So that's why God, through Hosea, told Israel, don't go to Gilgal and make Judah become guilty. The second place they were not to go to was Beth-Aven. Don't go up to Beth-Aven and take the oath as the Lord lives. Well, where is Beth-Aven? Well, actually, there was no place called Beth-Aven. Beth-Aven was a symbolic name that was given to Bethel, the house of God. Beit is Hebrew for the house, and El is Hebrew for God, house of God. Bethel, Bethel. Well, Beth-Aven is house of iniquity, house of sin. It was called that because Jeroboam had set up his calves there, his golden calf, Adam Clark says. And so it had a new name now, Beth-Aven. There was no actual city called Beth-Aven. But Hosea and Yahweh call it Beth-Aven because that's the better name for it now, house of iniquity. So don't go down there to your pagan shrine, northern Israelites, and say, as the Lord lives, I'll follow Jehovah, because you will be polluting the true divine worship of Yahweh. As Adam Clark says, Gilgal had been rendered infamous by the worship of idols after Jeroboam had set up his idolatry, so people were worshiping at Gilgal in an improper fashion, just like they were at Beth-Aven. So those two places, Gilgal and Beth-Aven, i.e. Bethel, they had special religious significance. They were being used by the northern Israelites to spread their corrupt religion. And so Hosea is saying, you better leave Judah alone as the Lord lives. They're not supposed to take that oath down there at Beth-Aven, at Bethel. That's the common way you swore back then, as the Lord lives. It's all over the Old Testament. Now, there's nothing wrong with saying as the Lord lives if you're actually swearing by Yahweh. Obviously, nothing wrong with that, but these idolaters were making an oath to their idolatrous God, a Yahweh who didn't exist. He did not exist under the form of a golden calf. We move now to Hosea chapter 4, verse 16. Yahweh continues through Hosea, for Israel is as obstinate as a stubborn cow. You ever try to move a cow when the cow didn't want to move? It's very difficult. They just sit there and look at you with those big brown eyes. For Israel is as obstinate as a stubborn cow. Can the Lord now shepherd them like a lamb in an open meadow? Some translations have a stubborn heifer, a young cow. The stubborn, he throws the yoke off his neck. He won't take the yoke because he's not broken in yet. I like stubborn cow better because I can just see those big old cows. They don't move. They're lazy. They're comfortable where they are, and they're very, very big. Well, Israel wasn't going to move. So can the Lord now shepherd them like a lamb in an open meadow, says Hosea in verse 16. Well, a large pasture is not so safe for a lamb as a small one, because in a small pasture, the shepherd can fence off the pasture and protect the lamb from wild beasts. But if you put a lamb in a large pasture, a large open field, open meadow, that little lamb's all alone out there by himself, and there's no fence to protect him, and a wolf can come get him. And so what God through Hosea is saying here is, I'm not going to shepherd you because you're like a lamb in an open meadow, and the great big Assyrian wolf's getting ready to come get you in 722. How can I shepherd you? You're obstinate. You won't move into the pasture that has a fence around it. You won't let me shepherd you into safety because you are a stubborn cow. We go now to Hosea 4, verses 17 through 19, and we will finish this chapter. God continues speaking through Hosea. Ephraim is joined to idols. Ephraim, of course, is the major tribe of northern Israel, often used as a symbol of the whole northern 10 tribes of northern Israel. So northern Israel, Ephraim, is joined to idols. Let him alone. Their liquor gone. They play the harlot continually. Their rulers dearly love shame. The The wind wraps them in its wings, and they will be ashamed because of their sacrifices. Now, the let him alone could refer to two different entities. Option number one, God could be speaking to Judah and say, leave Ephraim alone. Leave northern Israel alone. They're joined to idols. You don't want to do that. Or God could be speaking to Hosea. Ephraim is joined to idols, Hosea. Leave northern Israel alone. Forget them. They're not going to repent. I'm not sure which way it should go. Either way works okay, I guess. Verse 18. The idea here is that God is planning to let Ephraim alone, northern Israel alone, so everybody else should do the same thing. Leave them alone. Verse 18, their liquor gone. In other words, they've drunk themselves into drunkenness. They play the harlot continually. Isn't it interesting when people indulge their flesh, it's not only their sexual lust, but also they tend to be drunk when they do it. The KJV has their drink is sour. And Gill, using that translation, says, having drank so much that they cannot digest it, hence nauseous eructations with a filthy stench are belched out. Now, that's some purple prose. An eructation, I had to look it up. That's a burp, a belch. Let me read that again. Having drank so much that they cannot digest it, hence nauseous eructations with a filthy stench are belched out. They play the harlot continually. Their rulers dearly love shame and prostitution and harlotry. That's pretty shameful. Verse 19, the wind wraps them in its wings. The wind is going to carry them away into captivity. That's a very poetic way of saying it. Clark and Gill say that that is referring to the captivity carried out by the Assyrians in 722, and they will be ashamed because of their sacrifices. In other words, all the sacrifices they had made to idols. It's not going to do them any good. Instead of glory, they're going to be shamed when they're taken off into exile and utter national defeat. And in those sad words, we are now finished with Hosea 4. We are now prepared to go to Hosea 5. Hosea 5, I will entitle Punishment Coming for Israel and Judah. I hope you stay tuned with me for that sad story, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.